It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. From the 1820s to the 1870s, Ho-Chunk people faced what historian Stephen Kanchowitz called a long removal era, when the federal government tried to forcibly remove them from their ancestral lands in Wisconsin.
In just a bit, we'll talk with Kanchowitz about this history of Ho-Chunk resistance and what it means today, which he recounts in his latest book.
First, we look at ongoing efforts by the Ho-Chunk Nation to preserve and promote their language and culture. Josie Lee is director of the Ho-Chunk Nation Museum and Cultural Center. Josie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Can you talk about the general mission, the story that you're telling with the Ho-Chunk Nation Museum and Cultural Center?
Sure. So a lot of the things that we do within our museum are really focused on the appreciation of Ho-Chunk traditional culture as it was and what people maybe think of when they think about Ho-Chunk things. So things in the past, but really we try to focus a lot of the attention from the past in the reflections of how it looks here in present day. And what we can take from those things that were brought to us by our ancestors and really continue on in future generations of learners.
That's an interesting point, and I hear this again and again, the idea that in the past we focused on Native American history, a thing that happened back then, as opposed to, hey, this is still a living, breathing culture and tradition with living, breathing people now. Make the case for that being super important to keep at the front of our minds.
So often in the history of what is told of Wisconsin is the fact that Ho-Chunk people were removed, that we lived here in the past, but the U.S. government and the Badgers came in and removed the Ho-Chunk people out of their way so that they could establish civilization in the state of Wisconsin to make it what it is. But it forgets the fact that Ho-Chunks have been here and have continued to live here. And really, if it weren't for Ho-Chunk people, we wouldn't have the state as it exists today. You wouldn't have such a large agricultural industry with cranberries if it weren't for seasonal Ho-Chunk migrant workers in those fields. Nor would you have the tourist industry of Wisconsin Dells as it stands today without H.H. Bennett taking pictures of Ho-Chunk people and saying, come look at the Indians. So it's really, really important to remind your average everyday citizen that Ho-Chunks have existed. We've continued to exist alongside everyone else, and we are still here, still using our language and speaking that today, as well as using our culture and making sure that it is present and highly visible.
Zooming in on the museum, now, sadly, just a few years into its run, there was a fire last year. Plans up in the air for when that's going to reopen. Can you talk about the sort of things we might have seen in that collection and hopefully we'll someday be able to see again?
Yeah, so we have some really incredible baskets within our collection. A lot of people, when they think about Ho-Chunk art, think about basketry itself because that's what so many families use to survive and create subsistence for themselves. But we also have some watercolor paintings by Clarence Monagher, who was a fantastic wildlife watercolor painter. But we have a little bit of this and a little bit of that. We want to make sure that people, when they come in to, as tribal members come into our collection, we want to make sure that they're reflected within the pieces that we have. So if somebody wants to learn about hand-stitched applique, we have pieces of that within our collection that we can use to demonstrate how it was made, but also teach future learners how to continue making those pieces.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. At the museum, we could see those artifacts. At the cultural center, we can make our own artifacts, it sounds like. Can you talk about some of the craft workshops you run for tribal members?
Sure. So one of them that I'm currently doing is a moccasin making class, I think up in March at the House of Wellness. It's one of the tribal facilities that we run. But I teach virtual classes for kindergarten through 12th grade learners from all over the United States, as long as they are tribally enrolled or tribal descendants. I have taught anything from traditional dressmaking to Pendleton coats. And really, if there is something that tribal members want to learn, I will figure out how to get them.
I've had some great conversations here with people from various tribes in Wisconsin talking about a language revitalization, right? Making sure that future generations can keep a language going. Is that part of your work at the Ho-Chunk Cultural Center?
Yes and no. within each of our exhibits, we do try to make sure that language is incorporated into the text labels as well as how we talk about it. So any of our volunteers are taught the words that go alongside of the exhibit. We have also brought in language speakers to our craft classes so that as people are learning how to make something, they are also learning the words to go alongside of it. But outside of that, I highly recommend looking at the things that our language division is doing. They have a YouTube channel. They are teaching language classes virtually over Zoom. Honestly, they are doing really incredible things, and I only get to be a small part of it. But our museum is really excited to support all the things that our language division is doing.
And Josie, as I understand it, as I'm talking to you, you're waiting to go and actually teach a class right now. What class am I keeping you from?
So on Wednesdays, as part of a community building effort, I have started a brown bag craft lunch at the Tribal Executive Office building. It is just a way for people to get away from their desks for 30 minutes or so, gather together, work on whatever projects they have of their own, and then ask people within the group if they have questions on where to find additional resources, supplies, who does quilting, where do you buy your fabric? All the questions are able to be asked there.
Josie, I'll let you get back to it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you. Have a good day.
We've been talking with Josie Lee, director of the Ho-Chunk Nation Museum and Cultural Center, about her work preserving and promoting Ho-Chunk language and culture. Now, we take a trip through history back to the 19th century when Ho-Chunk people in Wisconsin faced a nearly 50-year period of removal from the state. We'll hear the story of why they're still here. Stephen Kantrowitz is a professor of history at UW-Madison. He's the author of the book Citizens of a Stolen Land, A Ho-Chunk History of the 19th Century United States. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
Now, in your book, you tell the story of how your perspective on this history changed after teaching a class about Ho-Chunk history in 2018, in part because of your students. Can you share that story with us?
Yeah, I taught a class in Ho-Chunk history a couple of times before, mostly to lower-level undergraduates. And when I raised the level of the class to 500, it became visible to auditors. And all of a sudden, I was getting request after request from tribal members to join the class, from Ho-Chunk tribal members. And of course, I said yes, but I knew that this would change the class in a lot of ways. And when they showed up, I, you know, maybe kind of naively presented the same material that I'd been presenting before. And among those early things was a map of the expulsions and returns of the Ho-Chunk people from Wisconsin in the 19th century. And I had expected that to generate the kind of like fervent discussion that it had in previous classes, and it just didn't. Things really felt very silent and flat. And I tried not to panic as a teacher, but finally, after the silence hung there for a while, one of the Ho-Chunk tribal members in the class said, "I don't want to talk about this map. I want to talk about a different map. I want to talk about the map of the places they told us never to go and the stories they told us why." And that left an impression that I've never really been able to shake, that what I had thought of as a kind of history that was bounded in time was a history that was continuing, that was very much live in the experiences and the daily lives and the family stories of Ho-Chunk people today in the 21st century in Wisconsin. And that lesson has really changed how I've thought about the entirety of Ho-Chunk history, about Native American history, about the United States itself.
Before we get into the story, that really, the climax of the book in some ways is 1873, but I want to talk about how you talk about this. I think when we learn about settler history in the Midwest and elsewhere and Native history, it's either, well, the Natives get left out, the settlers show up on an open landscape, or the Natives are an obstacle to be overcome, or maybe they're victims, right, who are moved around by the settlers. You very much tell a story where the Natives are people trying to figure out how to contend with this challenge as best they can, using tools they knew and trying to use tools of citizenship and property ownership and more.
Exactly. And this was one of the really eye-opening experiences in doing this research, is that this was not just a story of plight or deprivation, nor was it simply a story of a kind of fierce, determined resistance on the terms of a culture that predated American conquest and settlement. Instead, it was a kind of a mixture of both old tools of resistance and some really new ones that were drawn from the weapons of the conqueror themselves. So, for example, Ho-Chunk people in the 19th century, during an era when the federal government says, you have to be gone, are instead, first, buying property from the land office, establishing themselves as though they were American homesteaders on that land, but in fact, using that land to recreate what are essentially Ho-Chunk villages, and using American property relations as a kind of perimeter of safety around those villages. And then second, when the federal government begins to articulate a formal definition of citizenship after the Civil War, realizing that the slippages in that definition as they're evolving then leave room for Ho-Chunk people to claim that they are in fact citizens of Wisconsin and of the United States, and that they can on that basis have a right to remain in their homeland.
I want to set the stage for that moment a little bit with 50 plus years of efforts to move Native Americans out of Wisconsin, out of their land. As you put it in the book, we had at the national level this political movement that says we are going to take land from Native Americans and reward white settlers with it, and we're going to build a political movement that takes shape in Wisconsin with its first territorial governor, Governor Dodge, a miner, leading the way. Give us a quick overview of what that 50 years leading up to this 1873 moment looked like for the Ho-Chunk.
So those 50 years are years of tumult and trauma and enormous loss, in which the federal government repeatedly tries to deport or exile, banish the Ho-Chunk from their homeland to territories west of the Mississippi River. It's also a story of Ho-Chunk people refusing to be banished from Wisconsin, of quickly returning once banished from Wisconsin, and of, as I just suggested a minute ago, coming up with creative strategies that will enable them to create a stable existence for themselves, even as the landscape that they've called home is filling up with settlers.
You mentioned the idea of citizenship being key to this, and this is a weird timing coincidence. We have revisiting the 14th Amendment now from the new Trump administration, references to arguments over whether Native Americans were citizens in court briefings going on the week we're talking about this. Citizenship was a really fuzzy concept, I get, reading your book. And does it apply, frankly, does it apply to people who aren't white, was a big question at the time.
The status of Native Americans under the 14th Amendment is a very complicated one, leaving aside, you know, later laws and rulings and enactments that have clarified in the past, over the past century, that all Native Americans, whatever their tribal citizenship, are also citizens of the United States. But in 1866, when the 14th Amendment was drafted, it was not clear exactly what their status would be. There were thousands of Native people who had already been made citizens of the United States, and there were others who were effectively recognized as citizens of the United States by having been taxed locally, for example. But most Native Americans belonged to tribal nations, and unlike other foreign nations, the United States did not consider those tribal nations nations from which it would draw immigrants, but rather nations whose territory it reserved the right to seize at a future date. That's the fundamental rule of American conquest of the continent, is that the United States presumes that any native land that it wants, it will ultimately take.
So here we are, 1873, another round, basically, of the federal government making Ho-Chunk people move out from their land in Wisconsin. Over 200 Ho-Chunk people sign a petition for citizenship. Talk about that strategy and how we got there.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating moment because there are lots of moments in U.S. history in this period when various Native nations say, we want to become citizens of the United States. And mostly, the people asking for that are people who already are fluent in English, who wear what the federal government would come to call citizens' clothing, some of whom are Christian, etc., people for whom adaptation to living alongside settlers is an imaginable prospect. But this group of Ho-Chunk people, is a group of people who have persistently been uninterested in learning to speak English, in adapting American colonial forms of clothing, of housing, of subsistence. They want to live as Ho-Chunk people in their homeland. But what they've learned over their decades of interaction with officials trying to banish them from the state and with settlers around them is that there are certain ideas and words that they can use that may persuade the federal government that they're acceptable neighbors, and that among those key words is citizen. there are other words there. They use the rights of man. They use homesteads. They use they're throwing everything at the wall in this petition. Every key word that the federal government might be interested in and find appealing, they're throwing at them. But citizen is a key one because citizens do not get expelled, at least in theory, from their lands.
Another strategy is real estate. You mentioned going to the land office, buying land and saying, hey, government, I own this as an individual. This isn't tribal land. I own land. I'm a citizen. And then there's pushback from some Wisconsin leaders saying, no, you're wards of the federal government. You are not, you can't own land. How did that back and forth go?
Just like that, actually, with a kind of longstanding practice by which if people went to the land office, some land officers would simply sell them land if they had the cash and either could speak English or had an interpreter helping them figure out how to do it. And so by the post-Civil War era, there are small but significant number of Ho-Chunk people who own land. As the federal government gears up for that 1873-1874 expulsion, Ho-Chunk people are learning of it and realizing that one of the successful strategies of the past has been land ownership. And so they go to the land office and begin buying very small parcels of land, often in places they've never lived and never intend to live, just to have that deed in their pocket so that they can show it to removal officials and forestall their removal.
So this effort worked. We still have Ho-Chunk people in Wisconsin because of this story that you share. But I want to bring things back to that student in your class. We could look at that if we were making the movie of it. Yay, we won, roll credits. But there's still a very uncertain situation. The idea that a new effort could happen any year, right? A new removal effort might hatch up in any year or vigilante action or whatever. The story doesn't technically end in 1873.
Yeah. By 1875, at least in technical terms, Ho-Chunk people have the right to be in Wisconsin. They're citizens of Wisconsin. They're presumptively citizens of the federal government, although that's a little less clear for a while. But that doesn't mean, it turns out, that they feel like or are treated as equal citizens of Wisconsin or of the United States. And the degree of discrimination, racism, and hard feeling between them and settler populations remains intense. And, as Ho-Chunk Nation has become an employer and a recognized sort of political and social force in the state, I think many people feel and act as though it's all fine. But the history is much rougher and more complicated than that. And that's what the Ho-Chunk tribal member in my class was pointing to, is that it has been hard to be a Ho-Chunk person in Wisconsin for the 20th century, regardless of the fact that in technical terms, they were citizens of a state and nation.
We'll leave it there, Steve. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Stephen Kantrowitz, professor of history at UW-Madison, talking about his latest book, Citizens of a Stolen Land, A Ho-Chunk History of the 19th Century United States. Earlier, we heard from Josie Lee, director of the Ho-Chunk Nation Museum and Cultural Center, about ongoing efforts to tell the story of Ho-Chunk history and culture in Wisconsin.
Still ahead, when Wisconsin native Teresa Okokin was 9, her father traveled to his hometown in Nigeria and never returned.
I realized that part of why I wasn't telling the story of how he died is because there were so many variations of that story.
Okokin's new memoir is called Who I Always Was. That's next on Wisconsin Today.